This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, about 1,000 more people are thought to have died in the aftermath of the hurricane in Puerto Rico than were reported to authorities. An international human rights commission holds hearings on killer cops and impunity in the United States. And a noted publisher explains why it's no surprise that black people are being sold at auction in Libya.
But first, a group of black students at the University of Chicago are demanding that the school own up to its roots in the slave system and make reparations to the black community. The students' action could have embarrassing impact on Barack and Michelle Obama, who both have deep ties to the university. The students have been working with NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. NCOBRA co-chair Cam Howard says the University of Chicago is in violation of a local law that requires corporations and other institutions to acknowledge their links to the slave system or lose any contracts they may have with city government. Cam Howard explains.
There's a group of four graduate students in the history department of the University of Chicago who took it upon themselves to research the history of the university because, as you know, a lot of elite universities have had to face the fact that their past was built on the atrocities, the crimes against African people. And so this group of university students who call themselves Reparations at the University of Chicago Working Group uncovered that an enslaver and a big-time political figure in the U.S., Stephen Douglas, of the Douglas-Lincoln debates, was the donator of the land that the initial university was founded on. And Douglas had inherited a plantation in Mississippi. And it financed his political career. He moved to Chicago and became very big in real estate as well as in politics based on the resources that he gained from the plantation. And he subsequently donated the land to the university that became the University of Chicago in 1856 at the Bronzeville campus. And this was uncovered by the university students.
Well, what are the ramifications then for the University of Chicago, and what do the students demand?
Well, the ramifications are, and Cobra say they're criminal until they make amends, until they engage in some type of reparative process with the African community, African descendant community in Chicago. But the students' demands were three initially. They've been expanded now to five, but the three initial demands was one, that they university recognize the ancestors of those who they enslaved on the Douglas Plantation in Mississippi. And the Douglas Plantation, the overseer there was the most brutal, and even by enslaver standards, there were many planters who wanted this guy out of the state of Mississippi because he was so brutal in that process. And Douglas was notified of this on several occasions, and he just ignored the letters. And this guy just literally worked Africans to death in the periods of 2 to 3 years. They were literally being worked to death on the plantation.
This man was so bad that other slave owners in Mississippi wanted him gone.
That's exactly right. And so that's the tie from Mississippi and Chicago. And ironically, most Chicagoans that migrated from the South to Chicago came from Mississippi, the majority state of Southern migrants to Chicago. So that's also an irony. He was probably the one who ran them out. Yeah, so that was one of the demands, that they would recognize the ancestors who are living today of those who were enslaved on that plantation. And in fact, I talked with two of the students, and they're in Mississippi right now trying to talk to some of those descendants. They should recognize the descendants. That was the first demand. The second demand was that they recognize the official start date of the campus as 1856. And what they're trying to do is recognize a later start date. The land that was donated for the original University of Chicago was donated by Douglas in 1856. And he sought a number of wealthy donors, one of whom was Rockefeller and others, and that school got its founding and became a very prestigious school even at that time. But it ran into some financial difficulties, and they filed a bankruptcy and moved the campus, left that land, the Brownsville campus, and moved to its current Hyde Park location. And so that was probably 1870-ish. But the university now is saying that was its initial start date and not the 1856. But the students are claiming that although they didn't take any resources from the land over to the new campus, they took his other assets, all the professors, all the books in his libraries, even many of the donors, original donors, went with it to the second location. So we consider that the first campus as a predecessor company or a predecessor entity, which is also tied to the current university. And then the third demand was a comprehensive reparations project that would come out of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would be controlled by the community residents, be financed by the university, that would have a citywide scope to repair. So Incorporate initially supported all of their demands, but then we later came to also adopt their demands.
Now, if the University of Chicago was forced to be disconnected from city contracts, that would have dire consequences for the institution and maybe for the city too.
That's correct. What you're speaking of is when Incobra joined with the students, the Reparations of the University of Chicago Working Group, to assist them and getting their demands met, we realized that the University of Chicago, in denying this history, did not file a slavery disclosure ordinance with the city of Chicago as required by a 2002 law that was enacted by Alderwoman Dorothy Tillman, that any entity that wants to do business with the city must supply a report disclosing its profits from enslavement or its ties to enslavement. And again, the University of Chicago denying the start date of the university did not disclose. And so Incobra took upon it ourselves to craft a campaign calling on the mayor to enforce the disclosure ordinance with the University of Chicago. We sent out an open letter to the university students and staff, to the trustees and administrators, to Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of the city of Chicago, and to the Obamas. And the reason we also sent it to the Obamas is because the University of Chicago is the lead developer of the Obama Library. And so we're trying to use this as leverage to get these demands met. Because currently, as I stated, because they did not file a slavery disclosure report as required by the law states that all contracts with this entity must be voided. And that means even the halting of the continued development of the University of the Obama Library.
Well, the university must be fighting tooth and nail. Especially, it must be embarrassing since they are so closely linked to the new Obama Center.
That's exactly right. And they're not denying that an issue. In fact, one of their scholars who wrote the book, The History of the University of Chicago, from which these students got most of their information, they're not denying that the campus was founded on the Brownsville campus was founded on enslavement. What they're saying now and then is that it didn't carry over to the new campus, is that they had no ties, that initial campus was filed bankruptcy, and so it no longer existed. And so they're making the claim that they owe nothing because the new university was not founded on the Douglas proceeds. But, you know, even in that claim, they're still denying that they have any responsibility to the families or descendants of those who were injured, or that they were part of this criminal enterprise in which Incobra is saying to the students, to the staff, that you're criminal. They have inferred a criminal mantle on you because they benefited from crimes against humanity. Until they make repairs, then everyone who's still benefiting are still criminal. And so we're trying to get the students and the staff to get involved in it as well. There has been a student group on campus who also utilize in our language, that the university is making them criminal, a co-conspirator in this ongoing crime. And so they're embarrassed about it, but we want them to be more than embarrassed. We want them to actually come to the table and negotiate.
Yes, and the Obamas should be embarrassed by that link to slavery as well.
That's correct. And then in our letter, open letter, we talk about Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama also has ties to the university. She was a hospital administrator with the University of Chicago prior to becoming the First Lady. And Obama, of course, was a professor at the University of Chicago. And Michelle Obama talked about her feelings of being in the White House that her enslaved ancestors built. And we kind of put that in the letter, as well as Obama, in his last interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, he said that he favored reparations in theory if it was a Marshall-like plan. And so that's what we're calling for, a Marshall-like plan. And so if he favored it when he was leaving the White House, he should be favoring it now. And so we're calling on both Michelle and Barack to join and support the demands by the students and the COBRA.
And in terms of the University of Chicago's claim that the technical link to the slave estate was dissolved by bankruptcy, well, there would not have been a University of Chicago without Stephen Douglas, and Douglas wouldn't have had the money without that Mississippi plantation.
That's exactly right. And they couldn't have took these donors, the Rockefellers and others, to the Hyde Park campus if it wasn't for the initial Bronzeville campus. So the continuation of entities overlaps just the dissolution of the land base.
And the truth be told, since the wealth of this nation can be traced to slavery and, of course, the dispossession of the Native Americans, there's not a stick of furniture here that isn't linked to slavery.
That's exactly right. And more so than what we're also trying to interject in this conversation that hasn't been interjected with other universities who have ties to enslavement, is that more so than the profits being used to build the campuses, more so than that is the fact that these universities laid the moral, intellectual, so-called scientific foundation for the institution of enslavement. They produced tons of pseudoscience over the last period of enslavement and even after the period of enslavement that justified it, that dehumanized, that lent to the dehumanization of African people. And those type of things still exist. That type of the belief system in the minds of the masses still exists. So more so than the actual physical enslavement was this so-called pseudoscience that supported and that still supports the whole foundation of a racial hierarchy in America. And we call it the University of Chicago to task for that as well.
Yes, the University of Chicago is known as a center of neoliberal economic theory and is still turning out tons of capitalist propaganda closely linked to the slave institution.
That's exactly right. And I think Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, was a expose in the continuation of that type of exploitative policy coming out of the University of Chicago. When we look at reparation struggle in the context of public policy, this is one of the leading issues that we need to keep our eye on around the enforcement of slavery disclosure ordinances in cities that have them, because there's no national legislation other than H.R. 40, and there's not many new politicians trying to put forth any new legislation around reparations. So this is legislation that's been on the books for a while, and it's something that we can use now if we really attempt to enforce it and get it enforced to push the reparations movement forward.
So we should look at the Chicago ordinance and the various cases that you're trying to bring under it as a kind of reparations test law.
That's exactly right. I know that Philadelphia has a stronger slavery disclosure ordinance than Chicago's, but it's not being enforced either. So they're doing some things around getting it enforced. But here, because of this one is tied to such a big entity right now, the University of Chicago, and the project that they're engaged in, the Obama Center, we have an opportunity to really leverage disclosure, bringing this disclosure back out from the dustbins of the bureaucratic ordinances and rally around the process of getting it enforced that would get us closer to a reparations package.
That was Tam Howard of Encobra speaking from Chicago.
A recent study shows that about 1,000 more people probably died in the aftermath of the hurricane that ravaged Puerto Rico than were officially counted. Puerto Rico has been a colony of the United States for almost 120 years. The island's finances are in terrible shape. Unemployment is high, and people have been leaving for the mainland United States in large numbers in recent years. The hurricane only made the ongoing economic crisis much worse. Laura Merling is a researcher for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a Washington think tank. She's co-author of two recent reports on Puerto Rico, which is still waiting on $5 billion that was promised by the federal government to shore up the island's finances.
Actually, the $5 billion that was promised to Puerto Rico was as a loan, which is also pretty infuriating because Texas, Florida got a lot of help as grants, and then the bill included a loan for Puerto Rico, which already has a debt problem outside of this hurricane situation. And it's pretty ridiculous that the government offered them a loan. And it seems like they haven't given them that money either. And in terms of the death toll, the 1,000 is probably the more accurate one. There's been a few investigations that have looked into this, how difficult it is to declare a death as an official hurricane death and how it can be done only in this one place in the capital. So for a lot of bodies, they just don't even bother sending them there just because they don't want to delay the process of burying them.
Well, certainly, however, when we're talking about numbers that large, it is an indication of the mass trauma done to Puerto Rican society as a whole by that hurricane and the inability of the local governmental apparatus to cope with it.
Well, to better understand it, we have to go back in time a little before the hurricane. Puerto Rico was already facing a massive debt crisis, and last year, they had this fiscal oversight board imposed to them that was supposed to take care of the finances of the island and decide how the island can spend its money. So they had come up a year ago with a fiscal plan that already proposed very harsh austerity measures and was cutting funding from a lot of programs. And that's the background in which this hurricane happened. So it's not surprising that Puerto Rico's government had no ability to respond because a lot of their services were already suffering. They hadn't had many necessary infrastructure repairs, had been postponed because of this debt crisis. So it's actually expected that they couldn't really respond to the disaster. And this is really where the U.S. and FEMA should have stepped in and properly helped them.
Well, lots of Puerto Ricans are responding to the crisis by moving off of the island, which has been losing population at a very high rate in recent years. You calculated that providing Medicaid for Puerto Ricans who move to Florida, say, would actually cost billions of dollars more than providing an adequate Medicaid program in Puerto Rico itself.
Yes, exactly. So generally a lot of other things are more expensive in Puerto Rico than in the U.S., but one of the things that is significantly cheaper there, and it's about four times cheaper, is healthcare. So Medicaid there is a lot cheaper than it would be here, and if the program there can't continue, and people are already massively moving to mainland U.S., and they're all U.S. citizens, so the moment they move here, they're still eligible for the same type of services, and providing the care costs about four times more. So even if the U.S. government would pay 100% of Medicaid for Puerto Rico rather than trying to split a share for Puerto Rico's government and the U.S. government, they would still end up spending a lot less.
But the point you make in your report is that the United States government is being chintzy with the Medicaid program in Puerto Rico.
So the Medicaid program in Puerto Rico actually is about to run out of money. They have been struggling with funding for a lot of years because of this obscure cap that was passed at some point, and no one knows why, that says they have a limit on how much they can get reimbursed, which is about $300-something million. So that makes a reimbursement rate of less than 20%. And to understand how that works is, for states, the U.S. government reimburses them depending on how high the income in that state is, but it's always between 50 and 82% of what they spend on Medicaid is what they will get back. For Puerto Rico, if it would go under the same rules, they would be getting 82% back. Then there's this extra rule that says territories can only get at most 55%, which would still be a lot better than what they effectively have been getting for the past years, which is between 15 and 20% of what they're spending.
Obviously, U.S. policy on Puerto Rico has not worked. If success means raising living standards or even maintaining the living standards on that island, what's needed? What kind of U.S. policy, new policy towards Puerto Rico?
Puerto Rico has sort of been forgotten in the last 20 years by U.S. policymakers until actually this debt crisis imploded, and now there's also the hurricane that also brought Puerto Rico back in the spotlight. But it's at this point when the U.S. government should really help them and give them help to rebuild and offer them stimulus rather than forcing them to impose more and more austerity.
Well, the United States certainly owes Puerto Rico. It took Puerto Rico's sovereignty back in 1898.
Yes, so a big part of why Puerto Rico has this debt crisis and stagnating economy is because by not being a sovereign state, they were not really able to respond to any of the challenges that they faced. There was nothing they could do because the U.S. made them into a manufacturing base after World War II, but then once the WTO was created, that's the World Trade Organization, the U.S. started trading with China and producing pharmaceuticals there too, it sort of lost interest in Puerto Rico and forgot about them, and their economy collapsed. So right now, it would just be the fair thing to do that in the aftermath of this hurricane, since they're a territory, they should at least help them rebuild and offer the funding necessary, and it would just be fair to do that.
What you seem to be describing is not just a colony, but a kind of castaway colony, and one that the mother country, so to speak, no longer wants to sustain.
That's pretty accurate, because there was a lot of interest in Puerto Rico for manufacturing pharmaceuticals, because it was back in the day pretty hard to import pharmaceuticals into the U.S. because of health and safety standards. But since the World Trade Organization was created and some international standards appeared, Puerto Rico was no longer that attractive. And then there were these other tax incentives that made Puerto Rico attractive for manufacturing that were also eliminated in the late 90s. And then no one else in the U.S. really thought about what will happen to Puerto Rico or what to do next and how they could develop their economy.
And these 1,000 previously uncounted deaths that are related to the hurricane, well, the figure will continue to go up, won't it? Puerto Rico's infrastructure, health infrastructure, is still damaged in serious ways, which should lead to excess deaths.
Yes, that's why it's more important than ever for them to receive fair Medicaid funding, since a lot of the people that they're treating and are getting sick rely on Medicaid, and to prevent a public health crisis coming from this hurricane, where a lot of people still don't have electricity, not everyone had clean water, it's expected that people are just going to keep getting sicker, and they really need to be able to access good quality health care. If not, there's going to be a lot more deaths that could have been preventable.
Puerto Rico supposedly owes $74 billion in debt. Is there any conceivable way that that could ever be repaid?
No. there wasn't really before the hurricane. The fiscal plan that was released before the hurricane was completely unrealistic because it made these projections assuming that even if they cut spending and raise taxes, there won't be any negative effects coming from that on the economy and people won't leave. And even under those scenarios, all they could come up was $7 billion for debt repayment over the next 10 years. So there's no way they could have actually paid even the $7 billion. And there's definitely no way they can pay that back now.
So debt forgiveness seems to be the only option.
So it's debt forgiveness, and if not complete forgiveness, definitely at least a proper restructuring and big cutoffs, and also they cannot really start paying anything back until they achieve growth again, which will probably, it could take, you know, 5 years, 10 years. But yeah, a lot of the debt has to at least be heavily restructured.
There are a lot of folks who suspect that the United States, that is the people who rule, the people with money in the United States, would like to see Puerto Rico depopulated so that they could turn it into something else.
Well, there might be a grain of truth to that, and that's a very sad scenario because the people of Puerto Rico consider that island their home, and most people do not really want to leave the island. The reasons people cite when they leave are always economic, and they're leaving because they are looking for jobs. And it's sad to think that in our time, you could still basically colonize a place and kick everyone out, because depriving them of basic services is a way of kicking everyone out.
Then why is the United States not facing a political crisis over the hurricane in Puerto Rico?
Well, I think that there is a little bit more movement politically and a little more pressure on the issue, more than there's ever been before, because there's now people from Puerto Rico who live in the U.S. and are voting in the U.S. that are actually pressuring Congress to do something about it, and hopefully that will work out. The problem is that they're still very concentrated in specific areas, so their political power and influence is sort of limited to people in Congress from those areas.
And what about on the island of Puerto Rico itself?
Well, on the island of Puerto Rico, it seems like people are somewhat sympathetic to the fact that the governor's hands are tied because there's this fiscal oversight board that's named in Washington, D.C., and they have the control over every decision and a lot more control over things than their own governor does, which is also a good way to show that they are a colony and not a democracy, because their democratically elected governor has to ask this board for permission to do things and can't access any money or funds without the permission of this board.
And finally, President Trump certainly showed great insensitivity, throwing rolls of paper towels at folks in Puerto Rico and generally acting insensitive, as he usually does. But has his administration actually been any different than previous administrations in their treatment of the island?
Not really. It's certainly been more openly offensive, but at the end of the day, it's not that different. The previous administration, actually speaking of Medicaid, gave Puerto Rico this block grant in 2012 to help them out. But instead of looking for a long-term fix, they just sort of offered this Band-Aid solution for 6 years. And now they're running out of money. And I guess it's true that the current government in the U.S. seems less likely to even give them another grant or Band-Aid solution. So maybe there is a little bit of a difference.
So Puerto Rico was headed for dire straits next year regarding its Medicaid program, even if there had been no hurricane.
Yes, exactly. And what the hurricane does is just puts a lot more pressure on the healthcare system itself, just because it definitely affects just overall the public health situation on the island. And how many people will be getting sick and needing more health services.
That was Laura Merling of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights held hearings in Washington last week on the lack of accountability for police killing in the United States. The commission is part of the Organization of American States, representing most of the countries of the Western Hemisphere. Among those that testified at the hearing was Maria Hamilton, mother of Dontre Hamilton, a mentally challenged black man that was shot down in a hail of bullets by Milwaukee police in 2014. Ms. Hamilton told the commission that her son has still not gotten justice.
Dontre decided to go to Radio Park to rest and was profiled. And the officer, Christopher Manning, that incited Dontre's altercation was fired from his job after putting 14 bullets in my son, but he was never charged. I'm here today for the thousands of mothers who have lost their loved ones to police violence in the United States. There has been no justice in any of these shootings. There has been no justice for us as family members. We have went to the Justice Department. We have went to our local leaders to look over these investigations into police shootings and brutality. And once again, they have failed us. Our federal government has failed us. And we are now fighting for our children's lives who are no longer here. So I ask you all to please be supportive of all our lost loved ones today. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Adriana Camarena. I am a San Francisco activist who has been accompanying the family of Luis Góngora Pat since April 2016. Luis Góngora Pat was a Mayan Mexican migrant worker who was killed by San Francisco police on April 7, 2016. He was living homeless at the time. On April 7th of 2016, two officers, Sergeant Nate Steger and Officer Malone, arrived to the street where Luis was simply sitting on the ground. In less than 30 seconds, in blatant violation of all time and distance protocols, they exited their vehicle, they drew their weapons, they spoke to Luis, shouting commands in English that he did not understand, and immediately fired five beanbag rounds, followed by seven live rounds to fatally wound him. It still took Luis 3 hours to die in a nearby hospital. I would like to say that this was an uncommon occurrence in San Francisco, but unfortunately, it has become all too common. From 2014 to 2016, there were 11 police killings, 9 of them of people of color. During that period, there have been mass protests. There has even been a hunger strike that led to the ousting of the then chief of police, Greg Suhr. There have been promises of reform from Mayor Edwin Lee and promises of reform from the new chief, William Scott. But even so, in 2017, this year, we've had 3 police killings, the last one just last Friday. And for all these killings, the District Attorney George Gascon has filed not one single charge against these officers. I'm here before you, commissioners, to plead with you to put a spotlight on the systemic failures that lead to absolute impunity in police killings and denial of access to justice to these families. We want justice for Alex Nieto. We want justice for Mario Woods. We want justice for Amilcar Perez Lopez. We want justice for Jessica Williams, for Ocean Evans, for Luis Góngora Pat. Thank you.
My name is Justin Hansford. I'm the executive director of Howard University's Thurgood Marshall Center for Civil Rights. I've worked in Ferguson advocating for the family of Mike Brown. And over the years, we've heard the argument that these problems are the result of bad apples and that civil settlements in our courts will solve the problem. However, the stories you've heard so far and the data, I think, that will be presented to you in the records that are presented after the hearing will prove that that is incorrect. In truth, the problem is that there's a fundamental lack here. There's a lack of a sense of humanity for these people of color, and this lack of a sense of humanity includes a lack of a sense of sympathy, both in the state and local prosecutors, as well as local police unions. And the consistent prevention and obstruction of investigations into these killings are promoting the narrative that blue lives matter more than black or brown lives. And as long as that narrative continues to be promoted, accountability and reconciliation will be impossible. So one remedy that we're calling for is the need for independent investigations and untainted prosecutions for police violence. The United States incarcerates more people than any country in the history of the world. So we know that the remarkably low conviction rate for police killings is not by accident, and it's not for a lack of resources. State legislatures should pass legislation mandating standards for police union contracts that limit a police officer's ability to invoke qualified immunity against charges of excessive force. But putting police in jail is not enough. Secondly, we must also embark on a process of truth and hopefully reconciliation that leads to reparation. In South Africa, after apartheid, they created the historical reckoning that we need here in the United States on the issue of race and policing by having hearings and creating a mechanism that would possibly lead to restitution. Restitution not simply for crimes that happened hundreds of years ago, but for the crimes that are happening today, including the crimes you heard about this morning. States should establish victims' funds for families of victims of police brutality, because both extrajudicial killings and unwarranted police violence create great burdens on the healthcare, logistical and financial needs of families, and they can't wait for civil suits to be fully litigated before they receive any financial support. Also, these funds should be carved out of police budgets. Today, studies have shown that over 99.98% of police settlements for police brutality are indemnified by local government and taxpayer money, meaning neither police officers nor their departments pay a dime. So this means that there is no accountability today. My experience is that empty rhetoric about the regard for human rights is not enough to solve this problem. Primary regard resides in the pocketbook. Because our politics around race and law and order have made criminal accountability essentially a pipe dream, change will only come from attaching real financial penalties as well as transparent investigations for these extrajudicial killings. In conclusion, I hope my testimony reminds the committee that abuses must be repaid and apologized for before healthy relationships can even be conceived of between police and communities of color. In light of the elevated antagonism from leaders in the current administration, I hope that state and local jurisdictions will be responsive to our pleas on this issue. That remains our only hope. Thank you.
The chairperson of the hearing was Margaret May McCauley, a judge from Jamaica.
I must say that I understand this issue very well because I live in a country where we do have this problem quite a bit, and we have several cases within this body, which of course I'm not part of, the cases of my own country, but there are several in relation to police extrajudicial killings. But there's one difference, an area which is of concern, is that one needs an independent body to investigate the police. It cannot be the police itself investigating itself. nor ought it to be prosecutors who work closely with the police. We do have these crimes in Jamaica, but in the last few years since an independent body was set up, which was not popular with quite a lot of members of the police force, clearly, but which was welcomed by others who want the police to be better in the performance of their duties. They investigate, they prosecute for these offenses. And at least the general public feel that there's a spotlight on these actions by the police, which were treated with impunity as well, but now no longer. And one hopes that that will continue, but one never can tell with politicians anyway.
That was Margaret McCauley, a judge from Jamaica, chairing a hearing of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington.
Anyone that followed the U.S. and NATO attack on Libya in 2011 would not be surprised that black people are being sold as slaves at auction in that North African country, according to Robin Philpott, a Canadian publisher and radio host. Philpott published an influential book on the U.S. war against Libya, written by Maximilian Fort, titled Slouching Toward CERT. Philpott appeared recently on the Watching the Hawks show on RT Television. He said the racist nature of much of the opposition to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi had long been evident.
We could have seen this developing from the late 1990s. Muammar Gaddafi made it very clear that Libya was committed to Africa, was committed to African unity, and that was the founding meeting of the African Union was in Sirte, in 1999. And in that meeting, and it was attended by most of the African countries, and he made it very clear that the future in Africa was based on 3 points. We would have an African monetary fund in order to enable economic independence of African countries. And he would put his money where the mouth was, I'd say. He invested billions in African countries in support of this idea of an African Monetary Fund. Then he called African justice. He said there will not be an international criminal court that will come and try Africans. It will be an African court in cases of war crimes or crimes against humanity. And then he talked about African security would be ensured by African troops. There would be no non-African troops on the continent. Now, this was a very important declaration and widely supported. But within Libya, within a year, there were anti-black and anti-black African riots in certain areas of Libya. And Gaddafi managed to put it down. But I would say that that was the sign that there were people in that country who were opposed to Gaddafi, who were opposed to this support of Africa. They wanted to use the money from the oil for their own interests. And you'd say that was a sign that what we're seeing now was already developing. And then in 2011, when the so-called Arab Spring began, there were already signs of racial scapegoating in the Benghazi area in particular. That was where our insurgents, as we would say, our rebels in this Arab Spring were active, and they were scapegoating and even attacking black Libyans. And some of them are black Libyans, some are black Africans who were working. They're just workers in the area, and they were being scapegoated. This was February 2011. So you can see where this came from. It's also important to remember that the main pretext for a no-fly zone, which they carefully mutated into a regime change and assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, the main pretext was a great lie. You could say fake news, real fake news. That is the case of when they said that that Gaddafi was importing black African mercenaries to attack the people of Benghazi. And they used all this sexual image as well. That was what led the International Criminal Court, who was sort of like running interference for NATO, to say we're going to indict Gaddafi for giving Viagra to these mercenaries. This is fake news at its worst. And, you know, all the major media took the story and ran with it. I'm here in Canada, the Globe and Mail, and New York Times, and many others just kept telling the story. And there was absolutely no grounds for this story. Yet that was a pretext given to vote for a no-fly zone over Libya, and then NATO was here to apply that resolution, which turned into a massive bombing campaign and the final assassination of Muammar Gaddafi. So you can see where all this came from. The National Transition Council, which was the people who took over, while NATO was still bombing, made it clear that the new Libya was very much against African migrants, which also meant black Libyans, who are Libyan citizens. And they were going to change the new Libya, would break with its policy of African unity. African diplomats in Tripoli were being attacked. They were not being protected. The government and the army of the former Libyan administration could not protect the black population in Libya. And there are old Libyan black communities. There's one called Tawarga, which is east of Tripoli, where they were being massacred. And people were saying, we are going to reduce the blacks to a situation of slavery. I mean, there are quotes in Max Forte's book about that, saying that they were not going to be allowed to go to schools, they were not going to have access to health care, which in a sense, essence, makes it into a new kind of slavery. So all the signs were there before. So it is not a surprise what is going on now. And I think we should start looking for who the people are who are responsible for this. Gaddafi represented a rampart against certain imperial interests in Africa. You could say the war against Gaddafi was one for domination of Africa because of this position which I described earlier. So people were prepared to ally with them. It was very, very short-sighted. And it has created havoc in Libya. The flare-ups of jihadi attacks in West Africa, including Mali, I think are a direct result of removing Gaddafi. So I would say that the countries responsible, France, the UK, and the United States in particular, Canada was in there too, I want to mention, because I'm living here in Canada, their goal was chaos. I would say that their goal is chaos. And one of the results of chaos there is also what you call, what you said, described as a blowback.
Why would that benefit them to create this much chaos in Africa?
Well, the benefit is that nobody contests their presence. You know, Africa and Gaddafi, in one of his speeches, I was just going over it in preparation for this interview, he kept pointing out the wealth there is in Africa. Very little of that wealth actually remains in Africa. It's a lot of natural resources. And his policy, and I think if we're looking for the future, his policy was, any aid has to lead to increased wealth in Africa. That means value added, you know, like a secondary and tertiary transformation of natural resources. And if you look at the way the countries I mentioned operate in Africa, it's the opposite. Their so-called aid is only to aid their economies. And so Gaddafi's removal, look at France, if they were able to create a currency, an African currency, and Gaddafi had the means to do so, it would have taken the whole of the West Africa, French-speaking West Africa, out of the French zone. Countries like France don't want to give up that easily. And the United States operates in the same way. It does not want to have strong states who operate independently. And so whether on purpose, nobody, I don't think, was actually aiming to create slavery again. That was not part of the goal. The goal was to ensure that American, British, and French interests would be protected and would be continued to develop freely without a state which was saying, well, no, we're not going to do that. Maybe we'll deal with China. Maybe we'll deal just with ourselves. And an empire does not like that.
That sounds a lot like colonialism to me.
Well, in fact, if you look at the title of the book that I wrote, and it's not particularly about Libya, but North Africa, Rwanda, and the new scramble for Africa, we are in the process of what you could call a recolonization of Africa.
Yeah.
And I'd like to mention that one of the things in the future, we have to start respecting national sovereignty. respecting the will of countries to work independently. You have the case of Burundi, a very small country, but has decided to pull out of the International Criminal Court and to be independent, to work independently. And the spokesman for the president, who I interviewed on a radio program I do in French, said, we are currently watching an attempt to recolonize Africa. And that's what I think the story, what the official story about Rwanda has become that as well. So you could say that the Libyan, the overthrowing of and assassination of Muammar Gaddafi was a major step in this recolonization. It may not be the same, have the same image that it did after 1885 when they scrambled for Africa and divided it up, but essentially that is what's going on. President Obama said Libya was his worst mistake. I think he should get a lot more penalty than actually saying I made a mistake. But you make a mistake, then you've got to say, how do we correct this? Well, I would say the place to start is to see what Muammar Gaddafi said back in 1999, and which he said with in very close consultation with Nelson Mandela. Now, we all say we love Nelson Mandela. Mandela and Gaddafi were very close, and they had this Pan-African vision, one from South Africa and the other from North Africa, and the principle was you'd be independent countries, but independent economically. You do have African justice. In other words, I would say the first thing to do is put an end to the International Criminal Court. It's a Get Africa Court. It's essentially been that. If they want to go after justice, the people they have to go after are Cameron from the UK, Sarkozy from France, and Obama and Hillary Clinton. They were the ones who created the situation in Libya currently. So any aid has to be of aid to the economy in the country it is supposedly destined, and not an aid to the so-called donor country. And if you carefully examine all the projects in coming from donor countries, they are done to help the donor country's own economy. And I'm sorry, that just doesn't work that way. So if there's going to be aid, then it has to be towards developing economic independence of these countries and not dependence, which has been the case for as long as I remember. So there are 3 points. One is justice, he said, African justice, African economy, and African security. If you start counting the different places in Africa where there are European and American troops, it's mind-boggling.
Robin Philpott, speaking on the RT television program, Watching the Hawks.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, held a teach-in and protest march in Philadelphia over the weekend. Abu-Jamal has been behind bars for 35 years following his conviction and the death of a Philadelphia policeman. He had originally been sentenced to death, but now faces life in prison. From behind the walls, Mumia expressed his gratitude to those who have stuck by him all these years.
Dear brothers, sisters, comrades, friends on the move, as we meet today, we are living examples of a truly remarkable movement, a movement for life, for liberation, for resistance, and yes, for love. We have fought for these things for years, and yes, we fight for it today. But let me tell you something. Your love for your brother, me, has kept me safe and sane through almost 30 years on death row. Know this, throughout it all, I have never felt alone. To the eye, I was alone in solitary confinement on death row. But the eye cannot really see all that is. For behind brick and steel, I felt your love. Sometimes, like a wave. Sometimes, like a whisper. But always there, ever present. And even when you, the people, our people, pulled me off of death row, I felt you still in the air, like a fragrance from a flower, the scent of. And when I fell into a coma, literally, when I was unconscious, you were there, literally, just a few feet away, pulling me back into consciousness and back into life, into health, and into strength. I hope you feel my love and gratitude for all that you have done and all that we will do. Love begets love. And as we march on, this movement gets stronger and stronger every day. Thank you, all of you, for being there. We are on the move. I love you all. This is your brother, Mumia Abdul-Jabbar.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.